When Samson arrived at Lehi, the Philistines met him and came out shouting. The Lord's Spirit rushed over him. The ropes on his arms began to burn like linen, and the ties melted off his hands. He found a donkey's fresh jawbone, picked it up, and used it to attack 1,000 men. Samson said, "With the donkey's jawbone, stacks on stacks, with the donkey's jawbone, I have killed 1,000 men." When he finished speaking, he tossed away the jawbone. So that place became known as Ramoth-Lehi. Now Samson was very thirsty, so he called out to the Lord, "You are the one who allowed this great victory to be accomplished by your servant's hand. Am I now going to die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?" God split open the rock in Lehi, and water flowed out of it. When Samson drank, his energy returned and he was recharged. Thus, that place is called by the name of En-Hakkor in Lehi today. Samson led Israel for 20 years.
There are some ideas as a preacher that are just so cool when you first think of them. A few of those really cool ideas end up being as cool as you thought they would, like our Donkey Tales series. Over the last year, Dwayne the Donkey has done so much to support and encourage all of us while inviting good questions and growth. Those are the same things I want each of us to get from this, from the Bible, from the sermon series that we're doing that invites us into this Bible study type approach of the scriptures, that we might find support and encouragement, good questions and growth as we enjoy Donkey Tales. And then there's some of those initially cool ideas that leave you scratching your head, wondering what you were thinking when you first had them. Like today's scripture. When I was making a list of scriptures with donkeys in them, one of the very first scriptures that came to my mind was today's. Samson using a donkey's jawbone as a weapon. The story captivated me as a child. I mean, how cool! And then I sat down to prepare worship and write a sermon. And I read it. And I reread it. And I stared at my computer asking myself, "He just killed 1,000 people. What was I thinking?" So this becomes an entry point for today's conversation. There are a lot of scriptures in the Bible that are memorable, captivating, epic even. But when we look closely beneath the razzle-dazzle, the most outstanding of scriptures can leave us scratching our heads if we really look at the details. And that's because over the last century or so, there has been a push within Christianity to read these stories as historical narrative and as literally as possible. If we do so, we are missing the intention of the original storytellers, authors, and audiences. So today, I want to talk about heroes, violence, and an approach to the Bible. Samson is a hero of the Hebrew Scriptures. He comes at the end of a line of judges, leaders of the Hebrew people. Not judges sitting behind a bench, but judging the direction and decisions the community needed to discern. They were leaders. Last summer, we talked about Deborah, a woman who served as a judge leading the Hebrew people. Though come to think of it, her story too also had a gruesome twist in it. What we find in these stories of these larger-than-life characters that they represent something more than a person. They are heroes. Samson, throughout his story, Samson rips a lion in half with his bare hands. He ties torches to the tails of foxes and sets them off to burn the fields of his enemy. He kills 1,000 Philistines with a donkey bone. He will eventually tear down a temple while tied up after his hair gets cut and his power magically disappears. Samson is the kind of saga that young readers can be captivated by. I'm honestly surprised Netflix hasn't picked up an animated series called Samson and Friends. Oh, the trouble they would get into. People long for heroes. People long for heroes. Some we create as works of fiction. Others we elevate from reality into a kind of memory that amplifies their story. I find Samson in between these two, that his existence in the life of the Hebrew people could be very real. His story is also crafted beyond reality. But he was a source of hope and power, someone who could stand up to oppressive forces. He also offered a point of cultural shift, being the last in that lineage documented in the appropriately named book of Judges. He's unpredictable. He's outlandish. He's provocative. Some Hebrew Bible scholars point out that this sets the scene for the end of Judges as a way of directing the people. That the perfection in their leaders was sought by the people. It wasn't possible. Thus, as a hero, he serves a unique role, another function. See, beyond the celebrated heroic traits, he also is imperfect and offers at times almost a warning-like example. The story of Samson also offers us a chance today to discuss violence in the Bible. It can be very disturbing to read. I actually intentionally asked one of our older readers to handle this week's scripture, as there's something discomforting about having an 8-year-old read about a mass murder. Though when 8-year-olds do read these stories, they're doing so from the Bible we gave them. This is not the only time there are moments that are nearly unspeakable in our scriptures. Murders, genocides, some moments that could serve as the plot of a Law & Order SVU episode. And as the book of Exodus closes itself, we see the people crossing the Jordan River into the Promised Land. Oh, the land of milk and honey, the land God promised their ancestors, awaiting them after their long journey. What a beautiful conclusion to the book of Exodus. And then you turn the page, and you find that there are already people living there. And the book of Joshua is basically a violent saga as the people who already live there are pushed from the land. This is akin to what we see today in our scripture. The Hebrew people are at conflict with the Philistines. As often is, it's over land. It also has a subtext involving broken marriage vows and personal vendettas on Samson's side, just to top it off. And Samson ends up being led by his own people, a crowd of 3,000 of his own people, take him to be handed over to the Philistines so that they would not be annihilated as well. It was one of those, give us Samson and we'll spare the rest of you kind of moments. And what does Samson do? He finds a recently deceased donkey, grabs its jawbone and starts swinging it like a club. I was recounting the story to my son Joey this week, and after saying, well, there's no way that happened, he then said, he used his resources. That I get. Grabbing a weapon from inside an animal is actually an intentional storytelling device. I mentioned that previously Samson had ripped a lion in half. That story is followed by Samson returning to find a beehive that's taken home in the carcass of the lion. He reaches in and pulls out the sweetest tasting honey. Samson's story begins with sweet creation pulled from an animal and then turns to violence and death being pulled from an animal. It's an intentional juxtaposition. But what are we to do with this? What are we to do with this violence? There are not many examples or records outside of the scriptures themselves that any of these epic battles actually took place. So why are they here? There are some historians that believe the Hebrew people conquered the Promised Land by intermarrying and assimilating those who lived there, not through battle after battle. So why are these violent episodes in our scriptures? I see them as cathartic outlets, representations of the rage that an oppressed and exiled people would find encouraging and caring. When things got bad, they could look to these stories and feel there was potential for them, that heroes could arise, that foes could be vanquished. It gave a sense of validation to hear stories of God working through these moments to defend them, to uplift them, to honor them. Violence was also a very different reality in the everyday nature of the original audience. It was not uncommon for groups of people to encounter and engage in conflict over land and resources. It was very common. So these stories do not sit outside the ordinary when one studies other ancient texts from the same region and time. In fact, so many different groups recording stories of how they won epic battle after battle, including the groups that some texts say would have lost, but their texts say they won. I'm not even sure how it all adds up. How did everyone think they won? When we read stories of violence in the scriptures, it is hard to separate ourselves from a very contemporary sensibility about killing. Why would people honor Samson for killing 1,000 people? Why would God work through such violent acts? This has more to do with how we read the scriptures than anything else. You and I would not choose to glorify this story if it happened today. You and I would not write this story if we were simply creating an allegorical hero. And though it seems rather obvious, this was not written for you and I today, nor was it written today. When little Hebrew children heard these stories thousands of years ago, they were not being excited to violence. What they would first encounter was a hero that worked to care for them and their people. They would hear an invitation to be brave and never give up. As they grew older and heard the stories again, they could begin to engage the deeper layers. They would ask good questions and probe beneath the face value of the story. This is where our contemporary and very Christian method of engaging scripture is far too often inadequate. The methodology of the Hebrew scriptures was deep and intentional. It was even deep and intentional in how they were written and gathered together. This is based on the observations of one of my favorite Hebrew Bible scholars, Walter Brueggemann, in his book, The Creative Word. The Hebrew scriptures begin with the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. It is the teachings and the law. These stories were the foundation of life. They were learned immersively. They were stories of identity. To know these stories was to know who you were. But it did not stop there. After reading the Torah, then you would encounter the Nevi'im, the next set of books, the prophets. The books of the Hebrew Bible that challenge and hold people accountable. This is where the scriptures begin to push the people with questions, just as the people were invited to push the scriptures with questions. Are you living the meaning of the stories that you learned? How are you applying this? What does it all really mean? Have you looked deeper? Who are you and who will you choose to be? These are incredible questions asked over and over again by the prophets. And as children grew, this was their second stop. After the teachings and the law, after the stories that were the bedrock of their identity, they would encounter these questions as they grew. These questions did not pose a threat to their identity. They were not attempting to subvert the previous learning. To know and claim the stories of faith is to know and claim them well enough to examine them critically. After the Torah and the Nevi'im, we find the Ketuvim, the writings. These are the books like Psalms and Proverbs, Job and Ruth, books that take and apply it as wisdom, that weave into the life of people as liturgy, that take something from the text and apply it in the world. Walter Brueggemann noted that this construction, this order of things, is intentional and offers the rest of us a model for engaging the scriptures today. That we are invited to spend time with all of our stories and claim them, even in their imperfection. We're not claiming them as literal or perfect. We're claiming them as a part of who we are. They are God's stories and we are God's people. In the New Testament, they are the stories of Jesus and the earliest followers of Jesus, and we seek to live like Jesus today. So we claim the stories. But we do not stop there. Once we claim them, we must go further. We cannot make false idols out of the text. You see, then we must push and question. We must dig through the individual stories to seek out livable themes. The heart of the divine is not revealed in one verse pulled out of context. The heart of the divine is shown in repeated themes. We must also ask good questions of the text. And then we must ask good questions of ourselves. How are we living this? Who will we choose to be? And then as we seek those answers, we look for examples that show us wisdom. We honor the moments we see the answers lived while acknowledging the moments of failure. For wisdom is made of both. See, this is an invitation to approach the scriptures in such a way, especially when a story and a donkey's jawbone give us pause.